woke up this morning and it was in Czechoslovakia, a peaceful suburb of Prague, to be exact. It rained, so the lawns all glittered, and I had a splitting head from too much 80% vodka. Well, presumably so. The whole thing is a mystery, because now I talk the language. I have a beautiful Czech wife, three handsome, healthy Czech children. For the moment, their names escape me. A beautiful Czech house with a Czech roof, a beautiful Czech wife overlooking the Czech swimming pool. This is really quite some existence I've had carved out for myself. And I've read Kafka in the original, and all my old favourites like Philip Marlowe in handy pocket-sized Czech translations. Still, I have a job recollecting how I fell asleep beneath the shadow of the lame cow at the edge of Bulligan's field, in the drizzle, in the breezes whirling tractor blades, in the old sod. Yes, I have a job recollecting how I woke like this, hungover, in the suburb of Prague, which thankfully is very handy to all of the shops. What utter luxury. I'm Brendan Cleary. It's an absolute pleasure to be here in Cork. I'd like to thank Paul and anybody else involved for getting me here. It's lovely for you to come along tonight. I'm probably the only person living in this entire hemisphere who doesn't know anybody at all, nobody called Steve. Mark, Paul, Matthew, Tristan, Cecil, Marmaduke, Sadie, Sally, Sue, Priscilla, and little Yogi, but none of my friends and acquaintances are Steve. Nobody ever leans across on rush hour train and says, "Heard anything from old Steve lately?" Or, "Where are you and Big Steve off to at the weekend?" I spend my weekends going to drinking drugs parties. In my wide experience, no crazy-faced gate crashers have ever come to the gate with pleading eyes and bulging carryouts saying, "We're friends of Steve." Steve doesn't send me lonely letters from Southampton. Steve doesn't leave enigmatic messages on my machine. Steve doesn't ever pop by for a smoke in the afternoon. In the afternoon, the city clouds are pure and still, but Steve isn't there with me, high, calmly contemplating. He has never invited me out for a night to see Hellraiser 3. He has never lent me a fiver until Gyro Day. Not once. And I know there are many famous people out there called Steve. One plays snooker, one sings pop songs with some conviction. But how can I meet the famous? I used the same tea bag for a week. Meeting Steve would be like meeting a creature from another planet. Can anyone out there lend me a telescope to look for planet Steve? I thought I'd read some poems, some earlier poems, and then come and focus on the new collection, and then finish the gig with probably about 342 of the older ones. When poets are finishing their gigs, of course they say, "I'll do three more," and the first two are relatively short, and then a big wagon appears outside and started loading the 26 sonnet sequence. Those two poems came from the collection Going Down Slow, selected poems 1985 to 2010. Kind of hard to imagine a little fella of only three writing poems, isn't it? I'll do one more of those in the style of, from memory poems. I'm grateful that Kylie Minogue has stayed in the popular imagination, because I wrote her a poem a long time ago, We all have heroes or heroines. Mine's Kylie. It's called Kylie Be Mine. I celebrate it down the pub upon joining your fan club. There's such wildfire and magic in all your supreme machinery, and Kylie, it's profoundly tragic. You'll never cuddle up to me. I love you, my tasty chop suey. Your dance steps send me all gray. It never seems like hard labour when you take it to the top, my sugar pig, adorable neighbour. Don't ever, ever stop. Kylie, your face soothes all my fears. You touch me in places I've touched myself in for years. So we can safely say, having Kylie did once read that poem, I kid you not. She did. She didn't invite me anywhere. But we can safely say Miss Minogue has a sense of irony. Another thing poets do all the time, of course, is leap through their books, as I'm doing now. Is it right, fucking poem or not? I'll return now to a sequence I wrote way back in the 90s called The Irish Car, because I've lived in England a long time after growing up in the beleaguered six counties. I made a list when I wrote this sequence of poems of people that could be possibly offended by it, and it ran into about four or five A4 sheets. It included both sets of paramilitaries. you name it, they're offended. I'll read one from that sequence. It's the notion of inner exile in many ways. You know, you grow up in Ireland, you go to England, you come back to Ireland, they think you've turned into an English fella, and then in England they think, who's this alien? So there's a sense of never really knowing where home is in many ways. This is a poem called Rose. There was my ideal girl, even way back then, at Carrick Grammar. I knew how to find her across the water. You see, that's seen as a logical step, and entirely natural, to go via Liverpool or Stranraer to colleges and careers over on the mainland. And that was where I knew she was. For the want of a better name, let's call her Rose. I thought she might live somewhere like Hampshire, and she would have horses and speak with Marleys in her big. But I wouldn't mind because of her beauty and luster. No way, not after growing up with a stack of wee Millies, girls in Skinners and Crombies, always shouting over, "Hey, Master, my mate fancies you!" Or, "Master, go ahead!" Rose would be refined and schooled. We'd discuss all the books I long to read, those I'd never quite got round to, and one day I would have to go to her house like Bertie Wooster, to her luxurious country estate where her pompous father would want to know all about my people, and she'd be the pride of all Hampshire, but I'd charm her. I do it all the time, lower my voice an octave and use loads of quaint slang, and they'd love it, and if I was a bastard it would get me laid. The home counties can't ever comprehend me. I'm an outsider. It's a privilege to watch their class system in action, and I'm never thought of as pig ignorant, a bog man, but clever, not like McAlpine's men or pissheads from Kilburn. So Rose would be bowled over by my crack and lilting. It would all be unreal to her but enchanting. Talk about home, it must be so romantic. Is it really beautiful? She'd ask me, and if I burped or let off a stinker after dinner, she'd tap me, pretend to be disgusted, but I'd come off with some quip, some cliche, like, "Aye, sure, you can take the man out of the bog, but not the bog out of the man." And she'd be hooked again. Needless to say, this never happened, and I never met her. No matter where I am, nothing happens, and I never meet her. Thank you. well now to my new collection called Face. And Face is the name of my sadly departed, Face was the nickname of my sadly departed brother, Martin Cleary, who died in 2007. He was known sometimes as Face, the Face, Face Man, or Facey. Probably the only thing you need to know about Face that comes across in the poems is, I suppose he was a fanatical Manchester United supporter towards the end of his life. It seemed to be the one thing that was keeping him going. And the whole collection, Face, is in three sections. So I'll guide you through that by selecting poems from Face. When he died, for example, I remember my mother and myself received a fax from Sir Alex Ferguson. He was actually a very known, well-known Manchester United supporter. I'm going to read the opening section, which are short little poems interspersed with an asterisk. Two more from Face, and then move into the second section of the book, which is about loss, but that tends to be kind of boo-hoo-hoo, my girl left me section. You know, and then there's a third section, and then I'll return to some older work to finish. So this sequence just runs right through, and this is the opening sequence for Face. Father Dillon, at your grave, hands me a plastic shovel full of dust in the bitter wind, and then nods as I fling it in, then take out your Man United cap and throw it down on top of you, somewhere inside that coffin. 3 days before you fell over dead on the concrete near the green bit with Rusty and the tea bag, in the bunny mug near the kettle, you reckoned you were the only agent in the whole UK who'd backed Boston United in your £5 four-timer, and they were losing 3-0 at half-time. So I said, Face, I did them too. And we gently laughed, and then you went away. On your sofa blocked, and you've explained how you're going to cancel your Sky subscription for the third time in 20 minutes. And you've hit the brew with all the stress of having to print the gyros as well as issuing them, telling me straight, honest Brian, it will drive me to a heart attack. And all about that bitch, Tattoo Tit, and the other boss you told me often was a total wanker. Keith's crying at the bar, telling me he sent a few wee texts to your dead phone since, like the time O'Shea scored in the last minute against the Scousers. I remind Peter Kirby at your wake about the fire in your chimney, and as he knelt in his uniform on your hearth, you wound him up, saying it was great to see a West Ham man on his knees underneath your poster of King Eric Cantona. That lad tells me of his vodka past and how you followed him into the Jacks once to see if there was anything you could do when his wife was going through a wee cancer scare. During the World Cup, with the curtains drawn and cider and specials at 6 a.m, a whole gang of you, and Andy spilled his so Rusty licked it up, and you were outraged about him sending your dog back into rehab. Yesterday, in the gloom, I found a photo of you and Alex Best the night George came to the Dobbins for the Carrick Club and got blocked in white wine. So I place you and her on the little table near the kitchen door, where you keep match tickets, a few old badges and programmes, and a few old passport photos of you in the 70s when you had hair, loads of it, and a moustache, and looked like a Brazilian footballer. Old Tommy Killen reckons one day, during Deal or No Deal, he turned around and asked you, "Well, Martin," and you were there, on that stool, he swears. "I fucking saw him, Breton, I swear." But later, he came back from the Jacks, clutching the bar stools and the rail on the bar, which you weren't helping him back the way you used to. No dog sanctuary would do, and it was no good sending her down to D. Root's outhouse either, as he told me himself when you were over in the Amblehurst at the Birmingham game. She just cried and yelped and wouldn't settle for the whole weekend until you came back, lifted her onto your knee and tickled her tummy. Let's go back there together, parties on Christmas Eve, up in the bedroom in 55 Cable Road with the Kate Bush poster, loads of us blocked, and the day Mama asked Davy Root to come down to collect the sandwiches on the Pope's commemorative plate, and Big Tag drinking the peach schnapps down in one from a pint glass. Just inside the gates of the cemetery, their heads bowed, four guys in suits from the Carrick Club, from the Windrose, where you'd watch United games with Norwegian commentary. And I remember thinking, as they stepped forward, how you'd like it. They turned up and were about to take a lift of your coffin. I'll actually only read one from the next section, just I took a long time to give public utterance to the poems I wrote about Martin, and eventually I thought it would be the time had come to publish them. And in the process, I remember reading a fascinating preface written by the poet Ian Hamilton in his collection 60 Poems from Faber and Faber, where he says, "Did I think poetry, if perfect, could bring back the dead? Yes, I suppose I did." I'm not sure if I've got the perfect bit, but I've often felt when I read the poems that the fifth man's kicking about amongst us again. So I will actually read the two I was going to from the second little section of this, and then who knows what will happen. The big lorry will appear outside then. And this one's called Breakfast with Face. A large fry in the butter churn in Larne, one Saturday studying the coupon, and I'm scanning the sun with that advert. So I ask you, Face, what do you reckon to all this Harry Potter business then? So you cast a glance up from your plate. Specky little cunt, you reply, then silence. Okay. And this one's called Andy. In Keith's book, My Big Lily, you get a chapter, and he tells the tale of how you killed his cat, Andy Cole, one night hammered during some European tie, when you leaned heavily on his makeshift mantelpiece, and it just about pulverised the poor wee fucker. "I've killed wee Andy," you kept repeating, the lads winding you up in the bar. "Here's this, here's the cat killer." And about a week later, when you'd gone missing, Keith found you in his garden, placing your Man United badge on poor wee Andy's grave. Second section of the book's called In Company, and hopefully this is a more cheerful poem, although that wasn't an uncheerful poem. And this is a poem. For a while there, whilst I was living in Brighton, I was working as a rhythm and blues DJ. I thought that was a rather cool way of making a living. I was none other than Professor Hard Times. And this is a poem called It's Our Dance, and it's for a friend of mine who used to work in the bar where I was DJing, and she's called Lorna, so it's Our Dance for Lorna. Every Sunday I play Nina Simone's My Baby Just Cares For Me. And with a different flower in your hair every week, you spring out from the bar, and I leave the mixing desk, and we dance with our hangovers. Yes, we dance around the bar. And last week we ended up outside briefly on Lewis Road and the petrol cases, and we even waltzed out to the beer garden, and everybody smiles when we dance together to "My Baby Just Cares For Me." And for a few precious minutes, it's as if we have all swallowed the moon, and everyone is lighter, and the world might not ever end. A short love poem called Tomatoes. Nice catchy title. Tomatoes. So here I am, some morning in the future, buying tomatoes. And picking each one up to examine it, to see if this one is for me. As meanwhile people die in terrible car crashes on the M6. And the people who run the world rub their hands while I'm buying tomatoes, wishing you'd come up behind me, or if I went down the escalator, you'd be on the way up. I spent a lot of time at the dog track in Hove. I find it a very contemplative place to be, and sometimes a profitable place as well. And so this little sequence is called "At the Track." Look, dead people are coming back. My father and my brother, the two Martins, waving to me from the grandstand. Unless I'm mistaken, here in the leaves, there's my old lovers with their gleaming eyes, just beside the rails, forming an orderly queue. After the downpour, the track is definitely riding in favour of the outside traps. I want to turn around to tell you this, or ring you, or text, but you wouldn't want to hear about my feelings anymore, or my strange intuitions. Love just keeps letting me down slow, but it's fun watching the dog handlers in the weak sunshine, smiling, having a laugh, and there's no need to rush to the screens for the replay of the race, as Ballymac Benefit, the terrible three dog, reminds me of my failures. It's the yelp of hopeful promise. It's the blurred voice on the speaker. It's the clouds watching. It's the traps coated in shadows. It's the thud and paws stumbling and balking and speeding. Dogs chasing through my dreams. And a few more from Faith. They always say things. How am I doing? I'm doing all right for time. I'm doing this perfectly well. Yeah. Trouble is, you see, when you've written a vast amount like I have, where do you start? Where do you start? Like, you know, oh, read for half an hour. Think, well, I've written fucking millions. I mean, I could do a marathon. This is from a friend of mine called Michaela. And it's called Not Yet. Hardly surprising, your dad on the phone, explaining in detail the intricate laws of physics. When you say you're convinced, if you persevere, that is, in the madness and chaos and wind, eventually you'll levitate. That's quite a lot of cushions to be stacking up. And keep the best china at the bottom of the other kitchen. Keep your balance and concentrate. Forget about your da. Think only of lonely angels. Think about the dew this morning and the frost all over the roofs. Keep focus. Steady, girl. You can do it. And somehow I'll wait for you. Sure, look at those stars winking. I built a staircase up to me. I'll read two poems from the last sequence of the book. There, that's called The Ward. The poems were written when the person concerned was still alive. It was my mother. Two poems from that, and then I'll do some funnies to finish. New Spring. The busker with the checked shirt is churning out painted black as the deafening street cleaner trolley is shuffling through puddles on Ann Street. After the rains, I noticed in the afternoon half-light over a roof the faintest trace of the new spring, which I carry in my heart up to the ward. The girls next to me are on the phone, trying to book some sunbeds. Trains will be pulling out, buses too. Nearly everything is in place. Or so I convince myself as the wind cuts in, umbrellas sway, and I worry about this skin graft and whether you'll eat your toast tonight. And finally from this collection, The Hospital That Night. Pardon me. Dim on the wards with beeps bouncing around each other. At the station, a nurse with an extra fleece is writing up notes, glinting monitors. As I walk the empty foyer, listening to my shoes and my echoes. Then the odd patient in gown and pyjamas around 3:27 a.m. comes to join me. When I prize open the fire door, the smoke out there in the snow. All of the hearts of Belfast are beating, well, most of them, and oxygen masks are strapped on with nightmares, delirium, and snorers breaking the quiet, as every so often there's a screech of another siren drawing closer. Going to this little book here, Some Turbulent Weather. It comes from the... Nobody ever knows where that title comes from. Does anybody know where that title comes from? I don't usually do a Max Bygraves sort of thing, but does anybody know where that title could have come from?
Last week.
No, well, if you're ever in an airport, never get on flight 1203. You know, it's from an old Everly Brothers song called Ebony Eyes, where he's waiting on his last coming to marry him. And then... You know, there's a smulchy voiceover in the song, and it says, for those waiting for flight 1203, they may have run into some turbulent weather. So it's from Some Turbulent Weather. Sometimes you see, you find yourself in a situation where, this one time when I had one of those computers where you put little floppy disks in, and a disk got stuck in it. Mm. And so I ended up getting the thing you squeeze tea bags with, and I was kind of like on the windowsill trying to get the yolk out, you know. It occurred to me that, I mean, you could elaborate quite severely on this point that we all have outtakes from our life. So. And so I wrote this poem called Outtakes. I was squeezing the wine box when you called, in a kind of outtake from my cool existence. And I'd stamped on it, squished it about, and thought of Adrian's advice, just cut the corner with some scissors and let it slop. So I was relieved it was nothing serious you wanted to talk about. Not like anybody died, not like any horse was running, or you just wanted to hear the sound of my voice as if for the first time. I wrote a series of poems which are sometimes delivered in a quite laconic way, so I'll read some of those. They're shorties. First one I read is called Poem for R. It was a sunny afternoon, probably a Tuesday, when I tied you up because you wanted me to, and I had a silk scarf I bought in a charity shop, but but it did for a blindfold. And later we had pizza, or I think it was pizza. I'm actually about to return to live in the fair city of Brighton, so this is a poem called Brightonia. On your rooftop, smoking weed, and you told me I was the same age as your dad, and he was bearing up better than I was. So I looked over Brightonia and decided there and then not to pursue it, or you for that matter. Shocking when you've been with somebody and you bump into them and they're with their new lover. I wrote this poem in that situation. It's called Jim's Identity. Bumping into you and him in the pub with cobwebs on the Gateshead side of the Tyne Bridge, and you say, "This is Jim." So I say, "Jim? Surely not. I didn't know you were Jim. I've been calling you cunt for 3 months now. Is it not cunt, Jim?" So I think I'll do three more things. Times Literary Supplement, we're after that one, Mike. This one's called Knowledge. If I could go back, it would be to 72, when Jim Henry headbutted me at Carrick Station because I'd snogged Sharon McBride. And if I could go there, I'd knee the bastard in the bollocks, because I've learned so much since then. Gift. Was it my dilated pupils gave the game away? Or the smell of old Holborn in my hair? And I'd worked hard all of the morning on the bar stool with the racing post just to bring you that flower, pink and incredibly rare. Thank you very much. Lovely audience. Wonderful. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. So thank you again for listening, and I'll finish with one more. The highway's jammed up with broken heroes on a last chance power drive. Everybody's on the run tonight, but there ain't no place left to hide. Together we could live with the sadness. I love you with all the madness in my soul. And one day we'll get to the place where we really want to go, and we'll walk in the sun. But until then, tramps like us, we were born to run. Yeah.